Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Michelle Doolin on behalf of the appellant, Barnes & Noble, Inc. The issue before the Court today is whether the plaintiff in this case should be compelled to arbitration. And it's our position that the District Court below failed to consider the totality of the circumstances of this particular case. In this particular case, which is different than all of the cases that were cited by the plaintiff and that is urging both this Court and urge the District Court to follow, is here, the plaintiff is affirmatively trying to enforce a very specific term in the very contract that at the same time he's saying he's not bound by.
What about severability?
Severability is a complete red herring, Your Honor, because severability is an issue that the court would decide or an arbitrator would decide. The plaintiff does not get to pick and choose severability.
Why can't we decide it on appeal? For example, there is a severability provision, right?
There is a severability provision.
So if we analyze the contract based upon appropriate law, of course, choice of law is an issue, then why can't we decide whether or not it's severable?
Well, there's two reasons. The court can use its discretion to rule on issues that the district court did not rule on. However, the district court did not address the issue of unconscionability or severability below, and I don't think it's appropriate for the court at this time to actually make that finding. However, if the court was going to make that finding, in the sense of severability, the issue of severability would be very limited. There's case law, specifically the Federal Arbitration Act, the public policy is to enforce arbitration. And so when you're looking at what would be severed, it wouldn't be the entire provision. It should be with an eye to what is it exactly that could be severed to save the arbitration provision in its entirety, not the entire contract of
You're saying the case law does not look to save the contract first as opposed to the arbitration provision. The Federal Arbitration Act, I agree with you, certainly encourages arbitration. The Supreme Court has said that a number of times. But the issue of severability is often first to save the contract.
Well, the issue of severability would be severability of what? The plaintiffs are asking for the entire provision of the arbitration to be severed. But again, that's a broader issue than what I think would be appropriate for a court to consider. The issue to be considered would be within the arbitration provision, which would be, is there some particular line that, or particular term that could be severed to save the arbitration clause within the contract, not that we would just sever the arbitration provision in its entirety. But separate and apart from that, the issue here, again, with what severability, the problem here is not just severing. The plaintiff is specifically, of course, in the record, it's page 117 of the record, the plaintiff quotes, just because the plaintiff has alleged that one term is enforceable, it does not follow that the entire contract is enforceable. The plaintiff has cited absolutely no law to support that proposition. And this court in the Ninth Circuit has held in other cases that you don't get the benefits of a contract without taking the burdens. It's as simple as an employee coming on Friday to collect their check when they didn't do any of the work, and when they're asked about why they're collecting their check, and the employer says, well, you didn't do any of the work. They say, well, we don't want to pay attention to that part of it. We just want to show up and get paid. It's no different. And no case in any of these contexts where it's online, in person, in a paper contract, or by conduct, does a party, it's fundamental contract law, get to come into a court, file a nationwide class action, assert benefits of a particular clause that is literally within a half an inch next to the very clause they're saying they're not bound by?
I don't gather that that's what they're asking for. What they're asking for is that they thought they created a contract to purchase two 16GB HP touchpad tablets that were at a great discount because they ordered it and they received a confirmation of their order. but then Barnes & Noble was not able to fill that order, and so that's the breach or the fraud that they're, I don't know how they, I can't remember how they, this is the last case, very long, I can't remember what their precise claim is, but that's what they're saying, it was the fraudulent practice, was the advertisement, and that, that the contract they're relying on is the purchase of the book. And they didn't, the tablet, and they didn't get that when they had a confirmed order for it.
Well, they are relying on the terms of use that are at issue in them using the website, placing the purchase, placing a previous purchase, as well as placing the order at issue. So again,
well, so I don't even see why they would need to rely on the terms of use.
Well, they have, Your Honor. They have, Your Honor, because they're asserting they're a California resident, and the only basis upon which they can assert a claim under New York law is based on the terms of use.
But no one's even conducted a conflict of law analysis yet here.
No, the district court only looked at the issue of whether or not there was notice of this, of the terms of use, and only in a very limited manner. The district court failed on a couple of grounds. One, the court did not consider the ratification of the agreement.
I really think that that is also a red herring, because I'm sure once they, at some point, obviously an attorney got involved in this and got the terms of use to see what was going on here. And, you know, they were willing to go along with New York law applying, you know, once they learn about it. That's not necessarily the kind of intentional act by the plaintiff himself to create a ratification. Let's talk about, though, what your Barnes & Noble is really doing here. I know it's called a browse-wrap agreement. Because there's no requirement that there's any affirmative act by the customer to agree to the terms of use, right?
That's the plaintiff's position, and there is affirmative
action. What is the affirmative action?
Okay, so the affirmative action of that the plaintiff undertook in this particular case is a month prior to even the orders that are issued in this case, he went to the website. He did not just look at the website one time and flip through. He went to the website. He joined as a member of the website. He was using the website.
What do you mean he joined as a member of the website?
He became a member. He entered into information and about himself to be able to get benefits through shipping and other attributes of being a member of the website.
So was he a member of the website or a member of Barnes & Noble?
Barnes & Noble, Inc. through the website.
Well, wait a minute. What do you become a member in?
You're a member of the Barnes & Noble. There's like a club, if you will. And you're
shopping community?
Yes. But specifically, you get benefits for doing
well,
that. It's
before
not.
Before you sign up as a member, is there any requirement that you accept the terms of use?
There is, Your Honor. And there
Where is that in the record?
Okay. The issue of him placing his order in that context, he's also, so at that time he made a purchase. It wasn't just an order. He placed an order, he made a purchase. Throughout that process, again, what the district court did not look at is every single page that the person, Mr. the plaintiff, was, it was in visible view right before him. What the district court looked
at. You're not answering my question. I'm asking, what is the affirmative act that the plaintiff did when to agree to the terms of use?
There's three things. One, he was using the website. The terms of use bind him by using the website. He was using the website. He was using the website by making a purchase on the website a month previously, which when he gets to the screen, what the district court didn't look at was that it was on every page in the lower right, in the lower left-hand corner.
He had to scroll down, though.
That's one half of the equation, and that's what the court looked at, and that is clear error. Because on the record, in page 157, 158, 159, all the way through 64, It is not scrolling down, and that is the key difference between this fact and what the plaintiffs rely on in both the Specht case.
The problem is, though, it's terms of use, copyright, and privacy policy. Are you saying that anybody who purchases anything online from Barnes & Noble has to click on all those things? I buy things online. I never click on all those things. Are you saying I would be bound to arbitration or other things that could be in all of that just by going on the website?
And let me add to that also, it was just a link. It didn't give the exact details of what he was agreeing to, so it was a link.
Okay, two specific points. In this particular case, there was absolutely no scrolling necessary to see the link, terms of use.
I realize that distinguishes it from Justice Sotomayor's Second Circuit case. I realize that's a distinction from that particular case.
Yes, and it's also a distinction between the Hines case, which is the other case that the court ruled on, and in particular, the evidence in that case where the plaintiff said, I could not see it without scrolling. When an individual is engaging in a transaction, this is not a one-click transaction. This is not a free download. This is a commercial transaction where the person is sitting at a computer. They are getting to the screen. When they get to the screen, they've got to enter information, not just what's your favorite dog, your credit card information. You have to turn over and give your security code. You have to check your address.
So you're making an argument that any person who was responsible would before they turned over all this confidential information would check the terms of use?
Absolutely. You're required to look at if you choose not to read a contract, that's never a defense.
Well, you have to assent to it.
There's case law. I mean,
no case that's precisely on point with this one, except for one that neither party cited, which my law clerk found, and which frankly goes against you, but it's a district court opinion from somewhere. It's from Central District of Illinois. But in that case, it's exactly your term, but your thing, but in that case, before you could place your order, the last step was you review the terms. They told them to review the terms before they could place the order. So they were on notice that they needed to review the terms. Let me ask you, once you go to your terms of use, do you have a thing to set a click on for I agree or I disagree?
No. You don't have that, and that's the problem, isn't it?
That's not a problem, Your Honor.
Well, you don't think it's a problem, but ordinarily, you wouldn't be here if it had said, I accept. In fact, you have to get to the point. What you're saying is you have to be extraordinarily careful. And the question is whether a reasonably prudent user would have to have read the terms and condition, which was part of a link. Isn't that what you're saying? Is that... And do we look at this in conjunction then also with how is the agreement construed, against or in favor of Barnes & Noble?
First and foremost, when you're entering into a contract, whether you choose to read it or not is never a defense, and the case law is clear on that.
They weren't entering into a contract. They were buying a tablet.
They were placing an order, and they had in previously as well on the same website made a purchase. They had entered into a commercial transaction.
Out of this, does Barnes & Noble want the message to be don't shop at Barnes & Noble because if you order something online, you're going to get stuck with all these terms of use that you may never have even looked at or didn't even notice were there?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. Barnes & Noble's position is that the terms of use with a hyperlink, which has been decided in numerous cases, is notice. It's no different than the case of that this court decided in 1987, the De Niro versus American Airlines. In the airlines case, that individual was wanting to assert a claim against damage to their cargo, which happened to be dogs. Very unfortunate. 9 of them, I guess, died. But the reality is that customer basically said, yeah, I bought the ticket. This court said if it was only on the ticket, Maybe it's a close call, but we look at the facts. This person had traveled before. This particular plaintiff has his own website with terms of use on it in exact same format. In this case, the plaintiff has his own website with a link that says legal. He had used the website in the past. He's an avid user of the internet. He has multiple links to Facebook, all sorts of other websites that use similar.
Your position is that this case, it's case specific, and this particular plaintiff, reasonably prudent person, should have read the terms and before he agreed. Is that what you're saying?
I'm absolutely saying that
and either he did or he didn't. But assuming that he should have, he then would have had to agree to the arbitration.
He could have chose not to look at that, but
right.
Yes, he absolutely was on notice. There's case law, that Dinero case, what the court said was, he had, in that case, the testimony from that individual customer was, I saw stuff down there, I didn't look at it. Well, that's not a defense. If you choose not to read a contract, I mean, that the even when someone is illiterate and cannot read, if you know you know you're signing something, but you choose not to read it, it's not a defense. And that's basically what this plaintiff did. He came to our website, and what the district court did not consider on this particular case was what he did prior to even at issue, which is he made a purchase, he used the website, he was bound. He was not in some hurry-up situation. He didn't say anything about that. He used it in that particular time. He saw that screenshot 6 times in that transaction where he does not have to scroll. Then he comes back, he makes another order. Again, that's 12 pages where it's right there.
The issue of arbitration, though, is pretty significant, isn't it? So that if it merely says the terms and conditions, that doesn't alert somebody to you are giving up your right to sue. And so shouldn't it be clear that you better check this out? Because terms and conditions do not always include a waiver of litigation and an obligation to engage in arbitration. I mean, that the record doesn't establish that, and you're not asking us to find that as a matter of law, are you?
Terms of use is the trigger to, there are terms that are governing this. You want to know what they are, you need to look at them.
But if your client, which, of course, is enormously important to your client, wanted anybody who purchased something to waive their right to litigation, why would they just merely say terms of use and not say you accept waiving your right to litigation?
I don't think that there's a distinction between adding an arbitration provision in there to the terms of use. The terms of use cover all sorts of things.
Something as significant as this, anybody who's purchasing something, if you wanted them to be sure they understood they were waiving their right to litigation, wouldn't it be an ordinary prudent person would have expected they would have to have affirmatively accepted it?
The case law, it does not support that position, Your Honor. The case law, there are differences, and clearly cases will say, if you put a click, would that make it maybe at a different standard? Yes, but is that required? No. I mean, for example, in the Facebook case, the Feta versus Facebook case, very specifically, the court said, this person is an avid Facebook user, and they're coming in and they're suing, saying, I'm not bound by these terms of use. It's literally what it is. And the court says, we're not going to look at it and say, it needed to say, click here, terms of use. The paper contracts, I would argue, in an online context, the person has more notice than if it was an individual paper and you're just flipping to the end. You can automatically get to the end, right? In a multi-page contract, you say, okay, it's 3 pages, I go to the end. In this particular instance, the person is online, they are stopped throughout the process to enter information, and you can't just scroll down through the end. And you have to take the time to fill things out. And it is right there. It is 1 inch away. And it is no different than all of the paper contracts or the cruise line cases that says you could have them on the back and you can say turn over. It's no different. There's also a lot of the cases talk about the classic Apple case.
Do you have any one case where the terms of use were only available via hyperlink and the website did not explicitly warn the user that the terms applied?
I believe that the Hubert case, and I do believe that saying terms of use in today's world is disclosure right on its face, that there's terms and conditions, you're subject to it. Cases 15 years ago may have been different, but in today's world, and with this particular plaintiff who has his own website, it is disclosure.
Okay. Well,
and the Hubbard and the major case.
But you don't have a case that's directly on point.
I do. I have. There is no case specifically that includes all of the facts of our case, which I think our case makes it much stronger for my client because we have the unique factors of the plaintiff. We have the ratification after. Whether you hire a lawyer or not, you don't get to come in after the fact and say,
all right, you've made your arguments. Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Gretchen Carpenter representing Mr. Nguyen, and I have John Segley with me, and Mr. Nguyen is also in the courtroom today. I'd like to focus my argument on the key issue that the court has obviously already picked up on, which is that there was no agreement to arbitrate here, as the district court properly found. Just taking a look at the facts, what we have is someone logging on to barnesandnoble.com, attempting to purchase two touchpads during a fire sale, going through the checkout process, having no actual notice and no reason to notice the terms and conditions on the very bottom of the page in small font for what the plaintiff thought was a simple purchase transaction. Barnes & Noble.
No reasons to notice. So why don't you respond to what appellant counsel has said about reason to notice?
Your Honor,
Because it is a reasonably prudent user standard, isn't it?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So in this case, why?
In this case, we have a normal consumer purchasing a product on a website. We have, if you think you're engaging in a simple purchase transaction, doesn't put you on notice that there are terms of use on a website that apply specifically to your purchase transaction. And here we have a situation where there's absolutely no indication anywhere except within the terms of use themselves that says that these terms of use apply to a purchase transaction on the website. A reasonable person, if they notice the terms of use link at all, maybe thinks the terms of use apply to copyright and privacy type issues, which wouldn't be implicated by a simple purchase transaction. So we have Barnes & Noble not requiring an affirmative click that there's an assent to the terms of use in general or specifically to the arbitration clause therein. There's not even so much as a suggestion that the plaintiff should review the terms of use, nor is there anything during the checkout process that says you are going to be bound by these terms of use as soon as you click purchase.
So this case has implications for every person, every business that's selling things online right now, right? Do you agree with that?
Yes, Your Honor. And I believe what Barnes & Noble is effectively asking for is an exemption from the mutual assent requirement for an online purchase. Barnes & Noble, if you go into Barnes & Noble stores, I'm quite sure when you purchase a book, they're not handing you an almost 7,000-word contract and telling you that you are going to be bound by that.
Right. I happen to be a Barnes & Noble member. I have the card, and I do shop at Barnes & Noble, and I've never seen a terms of use in the in-store.
And there's no reason that the situation should be different here. We have the same type of a transaction. We have a consumer. This is not a commercial transaction in the sense of sophisticated commercial parties. This is a consumer case on behalf of consumers. And we have Mr. Nguyen testifying in his declaration that he did not notice the terms of use. It appears, in fact, that Barnes & Noble went fairly far out of its way to make sure that customers didn't know about the term.
Unlike in other cases, they did have it in contrast. It was a different color at the bottom. And you didn't have to scroll down on, in every case to see that. Doesn't that make a difference?
Your Honor, no, it doesn't. First of all, the scroll down is required on the first page, and it's also separated by substantial advertising material. I believe it shows up when you print out the page on page 5 or 6 of the, so that's on the home page. Once you start going through the checkout process, it is on the left-hand bottom of the page, and it is in a green underlined typeface. But the green appears throughout the actual web page. It's, I think, Barnes & Noble's logo has green in it. So it doesn't particularly stand out. And in any event, as the district court properly found, there wouldn't be any reason to know that those terms of use would apply to a transaction such as this.
Well, what if someone is looking at it, a reasonably prudent person, why wouldn't they look at it? I mean, what else are they going to think about when they see terms of use?
Well, that assumes, first of all, that the consumer even notices that there are terms of use, which here Mr. Nguyen didn't.
But why wouldn't a reasonably prudent purchaser be required to take a look at everything, as appellant's counsel said? It's on the paper. Why would a reasonably prudent person be allowed to ignore it?
Because from Mr. Nguyen's perspective, he's simply purchasing some touch pads in an online transaction. He's filling in his information and he's clicking purchase. That's the extent of the contractual relationship as far as Mr.
Nguyen. Terms of use. So why? Terms of use of what? What is a reasonably prudent person going to think that means?
A reasonably prudent person probably would have no idea what that means, and certainly don't believe.
Whose obligation is it?
It's Barnes & Noble's obligation to make sure it gets mutual assent for its contracts.
So you're saying that provision is construed against Barnes & Noble.
Absolutely.
They have an obligation to make sure if you're entering into this contract, you better know what it means.
Yes, Your Honor. I believe that's true.
So I have another question. Why did you make use of the agreement's choice of law provision when you believed that the agreement didn't bind your client?
Your Honor, I think you were dead on when you said earlier that...
That was just my speculation. I'm asking for what really happened.
That why did we include the choice of law
right.
clause? Because
that was included for the first time in the lawsuit, right?
In the complaint, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
And the contract at issue in the complaint is the purchase contract, and it's the contract I just described where Mr. Nguyen thought he was purchasing the touch pads, and there was a breach of that agreement because he never received them and his order was canceled. So that contract breach and the consumer claims that are asserted in the complaint, the statutory consumer claims, have nothing to do with those terms of use. And we did allege that the New York choice of law clause was enforceable in the complaint. And that was not a question of Mr. Nguyen saying, oh, here's these terms of use that apply to my contract, and I agree with this, and so let's include a choice of law clause. So based on the facts, the district court made clear that she was considering all of the facts, that she had read the briefs, and that she did hear oral argument, and she found, based on those facts, that the defendant didn't post the notice in a location where consumers would see it, and in fact didn't even give notice that the terms of use applied, and therefore there was no assent to arbitration. The district court did not ignore the plaintiff's evidence. It was all before the court, and the court acknowledged that it had read all the papers. Substantial case law does support the district court's ruling. We have the Second Circuit decision in the Specht case. We also have the Hines versus Overstock.com case, which is very closely on point. The court there didn't make a relevant distinction about whether there was a necessary scroll down on every page of the website. Also, the Zappos.com customer data security breach litigation cited in our briefs is nearly identical circumstances to those present here. Basically, Barnes & Noble's argument comes down to, because we placed the terms of use hyperlink within an inch to an inch and a half of where the customer had to input information in order to complete this purchase attempt, solely based on that fact, there was mutual assent here. And what that effectively will do is create an exemption for any online purchase transaction in a consumer setting like this. All of the cases cited by Barnes & Noble in this case are very easily distinguishable. The Hubbard case, which Ms. Doolin just mentioned, was a case where there were three online forms which said all sales are subject to Dell's terms and conditions. That doesn't exist here. Also in the Feta versus Facebook case, there was a note on the website that said, a representation on the website, by clicking sign up, you're agreeing that you read and agree to the terms. We're not talking about a case where the plaintiff was handed a contract and chose not to read it. That's not the situation.
Well, what's interesting is that we would clearly find him bound to the terms if there had been a box that said, I agree to the terms of condition that you had to click before you could place your order. Then we would I think we would clearly find him bound whether or not he had read the terms and conditions, because he had to do something affirmative. And this is a case where he's not even asked to look at the hyperlink. And I think that's what's problematic, you know. Are you aware of any particular case on point in this?
Well, Your Honor, the Zappos and the Hines case both found no agreements in those cases, and those cases are both cited in our briefs and very closely on point. I would argue the Specht case is also very closely on point.
And how are they closely on point?
Factually, because you have website internet transactions where there's a hyperlink, where they are trying to hold the one party to the terms and conditions of the website, where there's nothing to put the consumer on reasonable notice that they need to click on the terms and conditions.
So it says terms and conditions in those cases, or terms of use, or what is the language in those cases?
Your Honor, I apologize. I don't have it here, but they generally are terms, either terms and conditions or terms of use. I would be happy to look at
it. No, that's okay. I'm going to read it. Okay. But terms and conditions is probably would alert somebody that they better take a look at the conditions as opposed to terms of use. So we have terms of use here, and that's the parameters, right?
Your Honor, I don't think it would make a difference, because I think either way you need to tell someone that they're subject to those terms, regardless if it's called terms and conditions or if it's called terms of use or it's called terms of use privacy and copyright policy. You need to inform the consumer, other than in those hyperlinked terms of use, that they are bound by them. Very briefly, I would like to address the unconscionability issue, if the court doesn't have any further questions on the...
Well, you're just about out of time, so just get to it.
Okay, very briefly, I'd just like to point out that we also have a very serious unconscionability problem with this arbitration agreement. This is an arbitration agreement that was imposed under extremely procedurally unconscionable conditions, most of which we've already discussed.
Whose law applies on unconscionability?
Your Honor, I think the result would be the same under either law, but under the Ninth Circuit decision in the Negrompa case, I think because we're in diversity jurisdiction, that California law would apply to the unconscionability analysis. But either way, I believe the result would be the same, because what we have here is a very procedurally unconscionable contract, and the one-sidedness is very clear and undisputed. It specifically reserves Barnes & Noble the right to litigate in court at its discretion. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you very much. This case, Nguyen versus Barnes & Noble, will be submitted.